This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. The idea of humane treatment of animals is a relatively new one. The world's first animal protection law was enacted in 1822 in England, and previously that country, England, had gained a very bad reputation for cruelty. So, what caused such a change in attitude? When and how did it begin? Did an awareness that animals can suffer pain help pave the way for other reforms, other causes? These are some of the questions that scholar Catherine Chevalot takes up in her new book, For the Love of Animals, The Rise of the Animal Protection Movement. Catherine Chevalot is our guest in this portion of the program. We'll talk about the people who fought to change the way their world thought of animals in this portion of the program. And listeners, you're welcome to join our discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Catherine Chevalot is a specialist in 18th century British literature and culture. She's an award-winning professor at the University of California at San Diego. She and her husband live with three cats, Graham, Chloe, and Maxine. For the Love of Animals is published by Henry Holt and Company. More about our guest at her website, www.catherinechevalot.com. And Catherine is spelled with Y-N at the end, K-A-T-H-R-Y-N. And Chevalot is spelled S-H-E-V-E-L-O-W. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Catherine Chevalot, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, my pleasure.
How are the cats?
The cats are quite fine. A couple of them are sitting around in the room as
really?
We speak.
Actually, I've got the website up, so I can, too. I'm enjoying looking at their sweet faces as they pass by in the animated website here.
Oh, they're all characters, each in her own in his own way.
Yeah. I love that look on Graham's face.
Yes, he's very full of himself.
Yeah.
He's the one who likes to sit on my lap while I write at my computer.
Oh.
I think that he has, you know, kind of silent input while I'm writing.
Yeah. A muse.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, tell us how it was you became interested in the history of animal welfare.
Well, my general area of research and teaching is the 18th century, and I have always been an animal lover. We grew up with animals, and both cats and dogs and rabbits and guinea pigs, et cetera, fish, you know, everything. And it was one of those conjunction of interests, you know. I'm interested in how 18th century culture in lots of ways paved the way for things that we often take for granted or don't take for granted today. And I suppose the fact that Graham tends to sit on my lap while I'm writing and act as my muse, maybe he was sending me a signal that I should really write about him. And he, of course, like my other cats, he was a rescue cat. And, you know, I take for granted the sense, and we all do, the sense that, you know, rescuing animals is something we do. Many of us have rescued animals. We go to the Humane Society or, you know, an animal rescue group and adopt our animals. At least many of us do that. And it really is true that that's a relatively historically recent kind of attitude, the notion that animals even deserve rescue or that there would be groups that exist for not just the, you know, rescue and care of animals, but also groups that lobby for their protection, for greater protections under the law.
Yeah. Well, it is at the same time that we have these groups and these organizations out there working, the problem is still huge.
Yes, the problem is still huge. And one of the things that was interesting about the research I did for my book and thinking about the difference between now and then is that in the abuse of animals in the period that I write about in my book, which was really primarily the long 18th century, which begins at about 1660 and ends sometime towards the middle of the 18th or the 19th century, that's the period I focus on. But of course, discussion about animals and kind of philosophizing about animals goes back to antiquity and certainly through early Christianity. And one of the things that I noticed in doing the research, particularly about that 18th century period, is that although in many ways what people took for granted about, you know, what the status of animals was, the fact that humans really did have the right to do anything, whatever they wanted to animals, that animals were, you know, property, they were mm-hmm. beings who might even not be considered to feel pain at all, or at least certainly beings whose sufferings didn't matter. That, I think, was a much, much more widely spread idea on the individual level in those earlier historical periods. And, of course, it led to a lot of, you know, of egregious abuse and a lot of tolerance of the abuse of animals that people would see around them everywhere on the city streets. So in one way, you can talk about the plight of animals, the suffering of animals being much worse in earlier historical periods. But at the same time, when you think about the United States and our industrial farming system, our industrial meat production system, we probably inflict more suffering on larger numbers of animals than ever before, even though we also are a society that has more, you know, animal protection laws than any society ever before. So there's always that internal contradiction that we consider animals, we protect them, we don't assume that we can do anything we want to them, yet we also, many of us anyway, are kind of complicitous in various ways in the continuing, you know, widespread abuse of animals.
Yeah. Do you think change is on the horizon there?
Yes, I do. I think that there change is definitely on the horizon. I think it will be a long, slow process. It always has been. But I think that it is escalating. Every year there are more animal protection laws passed. And I think that the widespread attention to issues not just of animal cruelty but also environmentalism, also the world's food supply, global warming and the impact that has on food supply, that those issues come into play as well when we think about what we take for granted about the production of the food that we eat. That really large-scale industrial meat farming cannot continue in the way that it has continued. It does, you know, much too much environmental damage. And then, of course, when you add the issue of animal cruelty, that's another very powerful argument that more people are becoming conscious of, I think.
Yeah. You know? Well, the idea that animals are even capable of suffering, that idea that was absurd, that's hard for me to understand, but I think we should try.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you would tell us about Descartes and his view.
Yes, well, he was a French philosopher who argued essentially that animals are biological machines. Now, humans are biological machines as well, but humans possess immortal souls, which animals do not. And because animals are essentially mechanisms, they're organic mechanisms, and much more sophisticated ones than any that humans can make because they're made by God, as Descartes said, not by humans, that nonetheless they really did not have the capacity to suffer. They did not have intelligence or what they called understanding, but they didn't even, according to Descartes and his more extreme followers, did not even have the capability to feel pain, because in order to suffer, in order to feel pain, you had to possess understanding, and only humans possess understanding. So that can obviously lead to, you know, all sorts of egregious abuses and all sorts of just indifference to the suffering of animals because it simply was understood not to exist.
Yeah.
Now, it's important to say that not everybody was a Descartes follower, a Cartesian. And in particularly in England, there were quite a number of people who criticized that extreme position. But as one major historian of humans' relationship to nature commented, that it nonetheless was the best possible rationalization for how people actually did treat animals, regardless of whatever kind of philosophical, you know, argument they brought to support their treatment of animals. Mm-hmm. Most people didn't know about Descartes. You know, the ordinary person really didn't draw upon any kind of philosophical underpinnings for their behavior. They simply treated animals as animals had always been treated.
Yeah. Now tell us about Sir Isaac Newton. He was a cat fancier.
Yes, he was a cat fancier. Among his many contributions to the world is one that many cat lovers, anyway, would recognize, which is he is credited with the invention of the cat door. So that, you know, one of the inventions, the other one being, of course, the invention of cat litter, which was a 20th century invention, being one of the advances that made it possible, really, to adopt cats as indoor pets, as domesticated animals.
Yeah. So there were people who cared for and loved their animals, and to be sure, there were some that doted on them. Maybe you would share with our listeners the scene you paint of Lady Wentworth.
Ah, yes, Lady Wentworth. Lady Wentworth was an early 18th century aristocratic woman, and she wrote a series of really quite remarkable and quite wonderful letters, I mean, to various people, but particularly to her son, who served for many years as England's ambassador to the Berlin court. And Lady Wentworth would write about her family. Lady Wentworth's family, you know, in her widowhood with her children, you know, adult and grown, her family consisted of her pets, and particularly her favorite pets were a monkey, a lap dog, and a cat. And she would write stories about them and how they behaved and, you know, and their various kinds of frolics and how the monkey loved the lapdog's puppies as much as the monkeys, you know, as if they were the monkey's own puppies. And one of my favorite anecdotes is the day that Pug, which was the monkey's name, Pug won the lottery. She had actually picked out the winning ticket herself, and Lady Wentworth wrote her name on the ticket. Her full name was Jenny Pug. And she won a silver needle case and a thimble, which presumably she didn't use. But anyway.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Catherine Chevalot. She's the author most recently of For the Love of Animals, The Rise of the Animal Protection Movement. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now. A listener waiting to talk with us in Roscoe, line 4. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hi.
A couple of comments there. One is, there's other uses for kitty litter besides cat litter. and a lot of people don't know this, but paint cans, since we're in the recycling mode around here, recyclers don't usually take latex paint, which is that water-based stuff. And what I have found, and through research and things, that what you could do, when what I have done is, I don't have any cats in the house, by the way, anymore. Mine passed away. She was 22 just recently, about a couple years ago, I guess. But anyway, you take that paint, you pop the top off, and you pour kitty litter in it and let it set out and dry out a little bit, and then you could toss it in the garbage.
Well, that's brilliant. I love that. I had no idea.
Oh, yeah, you should have that in your book. And the other one is...
I should, with the next edition, maybe I should add
there you go.
Some helpful hints.
Well, when it comes out in paper.
The logistic uses it, and I'm finding out, the other thing is we ran out of salt this year because of the harsh winter, and I had a hard time getting in my driveway. I kept sliding all over the place, and I have a hard four-wheel drive pickup, and man, I'll tell you, it was like trying to drive on a hockey rink. What I did was, so I don't harm the environment, I basically took the bag of cat litter and dumped it on my driveway all over the place, and you know how it melts and refreezes, it actually added grip to, you know, the ground so you can get things in. So, you know, that's just another thing. The other idea is, I was wondering how you came up on the idea to write this book. I'll get off. Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks. Well, it really was my interest in animals in general, and my interest in what I think most people don't know. I mean, I think that when we think about you know, animal protection, we tend to take it for granted as something that, you know, that has always existed, or at least, you know, has existed for a long time, that these organizations have always existed. And I think that it comes as a kind of a shock to many people to find out that, in fact, it wasn't until 1822, which is really not that long ago in the large sweep of things, that the world's first national animal protection law was passed, the one that was passed in Great Britain. And now, it's certainly true that prior to that, there had been local ordinances of various sorts that either deliberately or as a side effect did protect animals. But not until 1822, you know, after about 20-odd years of fighting, fighting in Parliament, did that national law actually get passed. And, you know, that really is not that long ago. And it meant that social attitudes had to have changed. And so I got very interested about trying to just, you know, kind of track the trajectory of that change. And what I learned, which is what I expected really to learn, is that although there had been seeds of those changes many, many hundreds of years before, they really escalated during the 18th century. That the 100 years before that that law was first passed, those changes had escalated. There had to be a critical mass within society for Parliament to act. And I should also say that 2 years after the passage of that law, the world's first animal protection society that survived was formed, and that, of course, was a Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals that eventually became the Royal Society of the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and then some decades later, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals was formed.
Well, you mentioned the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. This was that happened because of Queen Victoria. How important
An
ally was she?
Excuse me, how important an ally?
Yes.
She was. I don't think that her contribution can be overstated, actually, because in the early years of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, the first few years in particular, you know, it was very much hit and miss, and whether they would survive or not was an open question. There had been a couple, particularly one earlier attempt to found such a society in Liverpool, interestingly, that had not lasted beyond the first couple of meetings, beyond the first few months. And the London Society, the one that actually did survive, you know, started out more strongly because it started out partially as an organization to enforce the legislation that had been passed 2 years previously. But there was a lot of both internal dissension and simply struggling to survive from a monetary standpoint because the donations were not exactly flooding in from all over the country, since many people thought that this organization was just ludicrous and, you know, a bunch of cranks, you know, trying to impose their you know, sense of behavior on other people, and an organization that was attempting to interfere with the property rights of people, you know, as they treated their animals. So it was very much hand to mouth for a number of years. And the first secretary, in fact, of the society, a clergyman named Arthur Broome, ended up getting thrown into debtor's prison because he bankrupted himself trying to keep the society afloat. So the point at which Queen Victoria joined the society before she became queen, when she was still Princess Victoria, was very important. And that was in 1837 or 1836, I believe, that she joined. And so far that not only her example, but that of other, you know, well-placed, wealthy, aristocratic women showed that there was some increasing social support among those who were well-positioned within society. So that was a very important moment. But, of course, when she became queen in 1837, what she did within a few years of her becoming queen was to give it the stamp of the crown, to give it the crown's protection. And that essentially ensured the survival of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Having that R in front of its name, that royal, that meant that it had essentially made it, and it would survive.
Let's take another call, a listener in Urbana now. Line one, hi.
Hello, good afternoon. I was taking some training recently in a different area, and we were told that the movement for animal rights and animal rights legislation and that really was a precursor to children's rights legislation, that the children's rights people kind of took their clues some from the animal rights, but animal rights actually came before, you know, child labor laws and other laws protecting children.
Yes,
which
yes,
is a
that's
fascinating
true.
Connection.
Yes, in fact, I mean, there's a very famous case, the very famous case of Mary Ellen Wilson, and this was in the United States. We're talking about 19th century America at this point. And Mary, I don't talk about this in my book because it's beyond the scope of my book, but Mary Ellen Wilson was the kind of case of the abused child around whom a protection agency for children gradually developed. And the interesting fact is that the neighbors and concerned citizens who reported her abuse went to the already founded Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And it went particularly to their founder and their president, Henry Berg, not because, as some people think to hear the story, that they were arguing that this girl, Mary Ellen Wilson, was an animal and therefore should be protected under animal protection, but that Henry Berg had a reputation as a compassionate man and an activist for compassion. And he, in fact, took up the case. He and his lawyer, got the child removed from the abusive adoptive parents. They had taken this child from an institution, essentially, to put her to work and beat her and tortured her, you know, ruthlessly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the myth around this story is that Mary Ellen Wilson's abuser was prosecuted under the auspices of the laws preventing cruelty to animals, and the argument was that she was an animal too, so she deserved protection. That's actually a myth. That's actually not true. The abuser was prosecuted under a part of the Habeas Corpus Act, actually. But it is quite true that Henry Berg and his lawyer were involved in this, and that, in fact, they were involved in the subsequent founding of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. So there is a direct connection in the person of these early animal rights advocates.
Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah, it's a really wonderful story.
Yeah, thank you.
You're
thank
welcome.
You for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Catherine Chevalot, author of For the Love of Animals, The Rise of the Animal Protection Movement. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Speaking of children, I'd like you to talk with us about the artist and satirist William Hogarth and his series of engravings that he called The Four Stages of Cruelty.
Yes, indeed. This was Hogarth was really the preeminent graphic satirist in the 18th century, and I think many people are familiar with his work today. Perhaps even people who don't know his name have probably seen somewhere or another instances of his work. And he painted and engraved satiric commentary, and all sorts of different social aspects. But he felt the cruelty to animals particularly acutely. He himself was a great lover of dogs, and he had pugs. One of his most famous self-portraits is kind of hilarious because it's a portrait of him and his pug, and Hogarth and his pug look exactly alike. I mean, they're dead ringers for one another, and you know that he, you know, was playing around with that and enjoyed kind of enhancing the similarity between the two. But he, in 1751, issued this series of four engravings called The Four Stages of Cruelty that follows the career of a character he calls Tom Nero, from childhood abuse of animals to his eventual hanging as a murderer and the dissection of his body by the College of Surgeons in London. And in the first plate of the four stages of cruelty, he shows a number of different instances of children, boys, always boys in this case, torturing animals in a variety of different ways. And these, in fact, were not exaggerated. They, you know, the only exaggeration about this plate is that he shows them all together in the same scene. These were very commonplace kinds of abuses of animals, children who would, I have fun tormenting animals in various ways. And part of Hogarth's point, which was one that was echoed in a number of different contexts in the 18th century, and particularly by people who came after Hogarth, was that cruelty in children leads to cruelty in humans, that abuse of animals by children leads to abuse of humans by adults, that it was necessary really to kind of foster compassion in children, to teach compassion and to crack down on childish cruelty, because the relationship between torturing a cat or a fly was a direct one to the kind of activities of abusing, of killing, of assaulting human beings later on. And this was one of the arguments that was often made by the early advocates for animals, was that there was a direct connection not only in the animal's ability to suffer and humans' ability to suffer, but attitudes towards animals leading to animal attitudes towards humans. Mm-hmm. If you develop compassion in a child towards animals, you develop a compassionate child who will be, as an adult, compassionate to humans as well.
What impact did those engravings have?
Well, I think they had, in certain ways, a considerable impact, not necessarily upon the people that Hogarth depicted, since many of them were laboring class people and probably illiterate, probably unable. They're certainly able to see the engravings in a print shop window, but they certainly weren't the people who would buy them or the people who would be able to read the captions necessarily underneath. But it helped to sponsor, a kind of collective, growing sense of that that animal abuse was something, was a social problem. And this was something that was particularly felt by the middle classes and the upper classes. I mean, there's no getting around the fact that this reform effort, like just about every other reform effort in, at this historical period, was an effort by the wealthier, more comfortable classes, and often, in fact, indeed, focused on abuses by the working classes. That's simply a fact. It's also a fact that the upper class sports, such as hunting, really could not be touched by animal advocates, even though many of them did want to try to do something about those sorts of aristocratic animal cruelties. In fact, the upper classes were far too politically powerful to, ever allow that to happen.
What was a bear garden?
A bear garden was a, there were several of these in various cities, and it was an arena in which blood sports took place, particularly the sports of bear baiting and bull baiting, and dog fighting as well. But bear baiting and bull baiting were very popular sports, very much associated by Europeans with the English in particular, in which a bear or a bull would be tethered in the center of a ring, and then groups of dogs, usually in groups of two or three, and these are the ancestor of the modern pit bulls, and that's where the name comes from, various kinds of bulldogs, would be set to attack the bull. And the idea, it was a gambling sport, and the idea was that you would bet on the dog, and you would bet on the dog that would do the best job of, of doing damage to the bull or the bear, or clamping most firmly onto the bull and the bear. And this was a sport that was, that started to wane during the 18th century, although it was not outlawed until 1835, and then continued illegally after that. But during particularly the earlier part of the 18th century, even though the term bear garden tended to signify rowdy, rough, lower class people, in fact, these were popular entertainments for all classes of society. And earlier periods, royalty were involved. Queen Elizabeth I was a great, she loved to hunt, but she also loved to set dogs on, on various kinds of animals. Mm-hmm. Many aristocratic families in earlier periods kept their own bears and their own bear keepers for precisely this sport.
What is the attraction of this today? It's so difficult for me to understand. Maybe you've thought about this, though, for, quite some time.
You mean of
dogfighting? Dogfighting today, it exists. It is underground, but it's in virtually every community.
Yes, it's very widespread, both in this country and in Britain. And, I think that it really, to say that it has to do with the kind of indifference to animals, I think, particularly the dogs, is kind of given. But I think it's also some kind of sense of, it's some kind of channel for violence and aggressiveness. And also, although I'm sure there are female dog baiters, there does seem to be a particular sense of masculinity that's also connected with this sport, like a kind of identification with the dog, with the triumphant dog that can rip apart all the other dogs that are pitted against it. And so I think that there is a kind of, of great pride in the dogs that succeed, and a kind of real personal identification, and also a great shame when one owns a dog that is defeated in the ring. It's almost a kind of personal shame. And if that dog isn't killed in the ring, it's often killed by its owners, often quite brutally, shortly thereafter. Now, that said, I should also say that part of the appeal is that it's a very lucrative gambling sport. In fact, there's a very definite economic appeal in the sense that it generates quite a lot of underground money for those who, especially those who have enough money to buy, stables, as it were, of fighting dogs and regularly pit them against others.
Yeah. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
My question is about animal hoarding.
Uh-huh.
I had just heard this expression. We'd all read about places where they find, 50, 60, 100 animals in a place, but I didn't know it had a term. And is this a psychological problem?
Yeah.
And are there laws against it? And I'm going to hang up and listen.
Yes. Yes, indeed, there are. Yes to both of your questions. My own cat, Graham, was a rescue cat from a cat hoarder. He was found in a house that had about 75 cats, most of them sick, emaciated. The woman who had them tried to feed them. The thing about animal hoarding is that it is animal cruelty, and it is considered animal cruelty and falls under the animal cruelty laws, but it's obviously a different kind of animal cruelty from those people who physically torture their dogs or their cats, because people who hoard animals often are animal lovers, and they, they think that they're protecting animals. And, of course, if the animals, if the cats, for instance, are not neutered, and they're usually not, because very often the animal hoarder could hardly afford to neuter all the animals that she or he compiles, then they produce litters. And so, there's this, this exponential kind of explosion of the population, and it tends to get out of control. And I often think that the cases of animal hoarders, and they're very sad cases because they spring very often, I think, from a real concern and caring for those cats. But they just, people who don't seem to have, a sense of limits or balance, people who just get overwhelmed by what's happened, people who might try to feed the animals but finally cannot and are just overwhelmed by the circumstances. So they definitely fall into the category of animal abusers, but I think they're more like inadvertent animal abusers than deliberate ones. Those animals, those cats, need to be rescued. But it's a kind of obsessive compulsive, disorder, as I understand it, which is not unlike other types of hoarding, like people who hoard old food or string or papers or whatever. That this is just practiced upon live animals, unfortunately, who can obviously suffer in ways that, food and string do not suffer.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting to see on Animal Planet the way that, those situations are handled by the Humane Society. And I'm often impressed with how rather, in some of these cases, the people who have this problem are treated really very gently by...
Yes, as they should be.
Yeah.
They should be, because they are often well-meaning people whose lives have gotten out of control.
Yeah, and it seems to me that I've seen people actually welcome the aid, the assistance, the resolution of such a serious
problem. Absolutely. I'm sure that that's true. True. I think that they must feel overwhelmed and kind of helpless.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Catherine Chevalot. She's the author of For the Love of Animals, The Rise of the Animal Protection Movement. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, we have about 10 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us with a question, a comment, give us a call, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now, another call, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. I have heard national figures in U.S. Agencies that deal with animal cruelty and animal rights talk about population control, and that's such a huge, especially in cats, and to some degree in dogs. I wonder where in the history of animal rights this kind of concern started being addressed by policy of the organizations.
That's a good question. I'm not sure I can exactly answer that, because I think it was, in fact, a 20th century phenomenon. I mean, you certainly had discussions about the overpopulation of such animals in the 19th century, but the sense that, for cats, for instance, I think the issue is primarily about cats, although, as you say, it's to some degree about dogs. In cats, because cats have traditionally, served a kind of function in the sense that they rid a town of rats, and so they have a kind of... There might be a reason to keep a feral cat population and to not think about that as an issue, because, in fact, that population is doing, something valuable to the community, which is keeping rats under control and therefore certain types of diseases under control. Now, this is a later realization. In earlier periods, there were epidemics of diseases, often cats and dogs, except feral cats and dogs, were considered responsible and were often, rounded up and clubbed to death. But the point at which the notion of actually interfering and neutering feral cats and dogs is I would say, in my understanding, probably a later 20th century phenomenon, having to do with the sense that, with the rise of shelters themselves and shelters becoming overburdened with these animals, so that they're not really able to... to take more in or have to euthanize animals in mass quantities. I mean, it wasn't until 1835 in Britain that an animal protection law was passed that even covered cats and dogs, that even covered cats, for instance, from being skinned alive, which was something that happened to them routinely, or dogs from any kind of abuse whatsoever. And it was still, when it was passed, it was still by large sectors of society considered to be absolutely ludicrous. I mean, it was one thing perhaps to protect horses, but to protect cats and dogs was just considered the most trivial misuse of parliamentary power that one could imagine.
Yeah, in 1822, that law that was passed was the Ill Treatment of Cattle Act, and it protected working animals.
Yes.
So let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just finished a couple biographies of William Wilberforce.
Yes.
Was a little bit later than some of the dates you've been mentioning, but I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to some of the work that he did in cruelty to animals. He was quite active in that, as well as, of course, the great anti-slavery campaigner of Parliament in the late 17, early 1800s.
Yes, sir, absolutely. Wilberforce was one of the founders of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and he had been one of the leading parliamentary proponents and defenders of anti-cruelty legislation from the first anti-cruelty bill, which was introduced in 1800. I mean, actually, the first bill, the first actual vote in 1800, Wilberforce had not was outside of the chambers and had been not been called, so he actually was not able to vote, which he was quite upset about. But in 1802, he did vote for the animal protection and spoke very eloquently for it. In 1800, a bill was introduced to regulate bull and bear baiting, bull baiting in particular. That was the first, what we would say was the first anti-cruelty or animal protection legislation ever, ever discussed, ever debated in Parliament. And that bill came about as a result of a group of people from a kind of country town not too far from London, a group of prominent citizens who were quite concerned about this sport, concerned about both the cruelty to the animal and the behavior of what they saw to be the rabble. The working class people who were seen to be the primary participants, and they came to London. And the first person they went to see was William Wilberforce. He was the person they automatically thought of, not just because of all of his work for the abolition of the slave trade, which was his great cause and the one that we know him most for today, but the fact that he was involved in just about every reform movement you can mention, in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. One of his biographers says that good causes attach themselves to Wilberforce like a pin, like pins to a magnet, and he exhausted himself and very much, very seriously damaged his health by his involvement in all of these many reform groups and reform activities that he was involved with. So animal cruelty was an important one for him. He asked those people to find another sponsor because he was ill at the time and he was overwhelmed. But he said if they were not able to find another parliamentary sponsor for the legislation, that he would do it. And they were able to find somebody else, but there's no doubt that Wilberforce would have done it, and he remained a strong advocate of animal protection, during his entire life, and certainly during his parliamentary career. Mm-hmm. He was one of the big, supporters of Richard Martin, who's the person who did introduce the bill that finally got passed into law and for whom the first Anti-Cruelty Act is named.
Yeah, and we're running down on time, but you've got to talk about Richard Martin.
Oh, yes, Humanity Dick. That was his name. I mean, he actually had many. He was an Irishman, the heir to the largest estate in Ireland, and he had been raised as a Protestant, although his family was actually Catholic. And one of his great causes, actually, the reason that his father raised him as a Protestant was to enable him to go into politics, because Catholics were not allowed to be elected to office in those days, so that he could join Parliament and fight for the Catholic emancipation, which he did do. His other great career, then, the one that he's really known for, became animal protection. He was a larger-than-life figure. He was a wild man in lots of ways. He was a notorious duelist, and he used to like to show off the dueling scars on his body. He was capable of, he would often crack jokes in Parliament. He would speak in a very strong Irish brogue. But he was also a very urbane and polished man who could speak in proper, as it was considered at the time, educated English accents as well. But he drove the first animal protection legislation through. He also was out there in the streets enforcing it after it was actually passed. And he, along with Wilberforce, was a founder of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. He's really a wonderful, colorful, larger-than-life character.
Yeah. Does he have a biographer?
Yes, he does. There is a biographer, biographer named Lynam, L-Y-N-A-M, first name Siobhan, S-H-E-V-A-W-N, and it's called Humanity Dick Martin, the King of Connemara. But it's not. It's the last biography. There are several others, but this is the best one, and it was published in I believe in the 1970s. It may not be in print anymore. Yeah. I'm not entirely sure of that.
There are so many wonderful characters.
There are.
In this story. We didn't also mention Margaret Cavendish.
Oh, she was wonderful. She was one of the great eccentrics and one of the great women intellectuals of her day, of the late 17th century, the late 1600s. And she wrote some really quite wonderful and quite often funny things about animals, in which she accused humans who thought that animals were, you know, inferior to be actually more stupid than the animals themselves. She was quite an eloquent and very eccentric noble woman.
Yeah. Boy, if only we could invite some of these folks to a party in the evening, a cocktail party or something.
Wouldn't that be marvelous? I would host it in a second.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Catherine Chevalot is the author of For the Love of Animals, The Rise of the Animal Protection Movement. The book is published by Henry Holton Company, and you'll find her at the website www.catherinechevalot.com. Catherine spelled K-A-T-H-R-Y-N, and Chevalot is S-H-E-V-E-L-O-T. And there will be a link to her website at our website on the Afternoon Magazine page at will.illinois.edu.